Who was most recently the author of The Surrendered. I said authored there. Chang Rae, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Well, good. I wanted to first of all start with a rather obvious question. This is the first novel you've actually written in third person, as opposed to the first three, Native Speaker, A Gesture Life, and Aloft, were all written in first person.
Yep.
And I'm curious as to how your sentences changed and how the writing voice changed when you took on the role of omniscient narrator.
Yeah, I didn't actually have a lot of trouble making the change. I mean, I'd written in third person before, obviously, you know, just little stories.
Yes.
And there. So in fact, I wasn't that unsettled by it. In fact, I felt really that I had a lot more liberty and license and freedom than I ever did before, because I felt as if when you're playing, you're sitting in the God seat, it's a good feeling.
Even amidst all this depressing activity.
Yeah, well, it's good to be God. Well, it's especially good because you can extricate yourself when you need to. And so I didn't actually have a problem, you know, just with that sort of switchover. It wasn't really a switchover to me. But what I did find was, on the other side of it, that there was a lot more possibility.
Mm. Too much, perhaps.
Well, that's the curse of any writer, really, is that you have infinite choices at every word and every sentence, and when you're outside of a consciousness of, say, a circumscribed first person consciousness, not that that's limited, you know, that's infinite too, but when you actually do have the ability to move in time and place as well, and you know, you're just going in all these dimensions.
Yeah.
So the choices you have just expand exponentially, mm-hmm. And you know, on first blush, they all look pretty decent.
Yeah.
Right. And the feeling is, my goodness, I've got to rein it in here, and really bear down and think, you know, where do I need to go that's going to make any sense.
By extricate yourself, what do you mean by that?
Well,
exactly?
Particularly in this book, sometimes I would stop certain sections because, obviously, because if I thought things weren't going right in the right direction. But also, with this book, there are a lot of difficult moments. There are a lot of harrowing scenes. There are a lot of, and not just external action scenes, but there's some scenes of, of inner life that are, you know, I found kind of difficult.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I always felt a little tortured by in the first three books is that, you know, I have to live with this person and be this person and channel this person for 3 or 4 years. And in The Surrendered, you know, you get a chance to switch gears.
Well, there's a portion of in the first third of the book where June almost disappears entirely. And so this leads me to ask you whether you got sick of one particular character. And this is what caused most of these interesting digressions, often, you know, 50 pages, 100 pages away. I mean, one of the interesting aspects of this book was flipping to wonder which character we're going to go back to again.
Yeah.
It's almost you would get sick of the character either way, whether it's first person or third person.
Yeah, you do get quote unquote sick, but you get, I don't know, you just the weight of that, of just being with someone's personality and consciousness, after a while, just gets old. And but as you read the book, as it appears to you, is not actually how I, you know, the sequence of how I wrote it. So
I have a feeling.
Yeah. So there, you know, and I don't quite remember how long I would spend on each, you know, if I would do two chapters of the same person and then move on. And I can't quite backtrack, you know, faithfully in my mind, you know, how I did it. But yeah, you know, you'd write a chapter and you'd be, you know, completely imbued in this person's, you know, being, and it was lovely to switch gears. I felt as if I was writing, you know, short stories again.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't write short stories professionally. I used to, you know, before I started publishing. And one of the things, of course, that I miss about that is, finishing off a character. Of course, in the novel, you don't finish it off, but in chapters, you can have the dream of finishing them off just right there, you know.
You mentioned the inner life earlier, but you don't allude to the brutality that is within this book, and this leads me to naturally ask, based off of your confession earlier that it was all out of sequence, exactly what you did to work yourself up for, oh, here's the rape scene! I try to be as jocular as I can under the circumstances, but what did you do to work yourself into this extremely intense groove of the ravages of war?
Right, well, one of the things that I found myself doing, I don't think I did this consciously, was to actually begin very quietly in all those scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Really kind of gearing up very slowly through detail and also building a sense of suspense, suspending the difficult action, partly because, you know, for literary reasons, but partly because, you know, writing some of these scenes, afterwards I'd feel obliterated.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't quite friggin' believe that I was, you know, that this was in my head. Yeah. And then also, just from the difficult things and awful things that happen, you just read, you're just human. You know,
yeah.
You read about these things, and I'm not saying that I was blown away by my own work, but I'm just saying just the fact of a murder, or a fact of brutality or cruelty, and to describe it so puts you into a mindset that is pretty frightening.
Did you find yourself sometimes approaching something extremely violent or intense and say, oh, well, that actually came really easily? I mean, I talked to Brian Evanson, and I was asking about this extremely warped aspect in one of his books, and he said, oh, well, that came out like that. Did you find anything similar like that in the writing of this?
I can't quite report that I found it came too easily. I did find myself, though, fascinated. I've always been fascinated by violence, and in my other books, or particularly in A Gesture Life, there are some scenes of horrific violence. And scenes that, again, I had a lot of difficulty writing, and I had to really try to, marshal what I felt was left of me afterwards. But I do find the scenes just compelling for what they show about human possibility.
Yeah.
You know, that's what all novelists write about, is human possibility in every direction, right? And the glorious, and the beautiful, and the homely, and in this case, the dark.
Yeah.
And that's stuff that's always attracted me.
Yeah.
And maybe I don't know why, but for me that's one of the the pulses of being that is so elemental, and can't be, it can never sort of be ignored.
I wanted to ask you also about the sentences. First of all, you mentioned time and space earlier, and you often introduce a very intriguing clause that spells out the precise location or reflects upon a condition. Sometimes it exists to almost qualify a simile or to split a particular description into two, which I found quite interesting. But this leads me to wonder whether some of the syllables, the rhyming syllables, the internal rhyme that's there, actually helped you to serve as a guide to put together a difficult circumstance, whether it involved the inner life or whether it involved the ravages of war or some really intense situation.
Well, I don't know exactly what you're talking about, if you gave me an example, but I mean, my feeling is always, I've always been very conscious of language.
Yeah.
For me, it might seem silly for me to say, given all the things that have happened in my books, but I'm not terribly interested in plot.
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoy it, but I find, for me, the real action and drama is in the play of the sentences, in the play of the words, and that's what draws me through the story too. I mean, unless I hear the sentence, I don't understand what it really means.
Yeah.
And even when I was back in school, when I was writing a lot more essays, I would always try to craft it so that it felt like something and it sounded like something to me rather than just said something. And particularly vis-a-vis the scenes of violence, I wanted to, I think in this book too, in Gesture Life too, I tried to think to myself, what was the most, in some ways, unlikely way to describe this, with perhaps kind of a spare and beautiful language that would seem, that would add a layer of a different kind of horror to the moment. Just the contrast between how not lovely, but how sort of, how handsome everything seemed and normal, given what was happening.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it also makes me ask whether you could ever possibly stop work in the middle of a sentence, or whether this would actually drive you insane over the course of the day.
No, I can never do that. I mean, that's my problem as a writer, is that I work the sentences so long. And even the very plain ones that probably don't seem to anyone that they've been worked, I work
like a five word sentence.
Yeah, I work them and work them and work them until each one satisfies certain requirements and follows up the last sentence and fulfills or promises something about the next one. So it's not a great way to write in some ways, because at the end of a paragraph, I often feel as if, okay, this is a pretty good paragraph. But sometimes that paragraph is completely useless because it's irrelevant or it's not quite looking at the right thing.
Well, let's expand to the chapter units. I mean, these are rather lengthy chapters. And so this also makes me wonder when you knew the chapter was done, if you're constantly working and crafting these sentences.
I mean, let me tell you, I threw away chapters. I threw away many chapters, they do get done.
Yeah.
But often they're just irrelevant. And this has been my mode in all my novels.
Yeah.
And it's a maddening, frustrating mode, because I do tend to like chapters that are a little bit longer. It just appeals to me somehow, the rhythm that I get in having a little full narrative in each chapter, and a fully detailed scene. But and again, they're all like little tiny, little tiny books.
Well, this also leads me to ask, quite naturally, I mean, there has to be an advantage in tossing away a chapter, because you didn't get it this time, but you knew. You may have had a rough idea of what worked, and you know that you can possibly recapture those particular elements and try again and get it right. Or does the process work like that for you?
No, it definitely helps. I mean, the second time around, you're much more aware. It's just you have to get over the excruciating pain of having thrown away that chapter.
Yeah.
And feeling as if there were good parts of it, but just, that I probably can't use anymore. Because the whole thing for me is, again, the whole chapter has to feel that it has a certain kind of rhetorical orchestration.
Yeah.
And even, musical orchestration that, for me at least, that I hear. And maybe it's because I grew up writing poetry first, and in some ways I was raised by poets, as I was learning the craft, and I'm still learning, but I've always been attuned to meter and a certain kind of stressing and a certain kind of musicality.
So you cannibalize essentially with the subconscious with these second attempts. Is that how you would put it? You throw it away. You don't look at it ever again. The false starts when you say
have
the
board. Well, I'll sometimes look at them, but again, it's painful to look at them.
Yeah,
because in and of themselves, they seem okay. Mm-hmm. And that's what I tell my writing students, is that it's not a matter of writing well, ultimately. I mean, that's not the only matter, right? It has to fulfill all the things that you've been writing up to that moment, and connect up in a mysterious way, in an ineffable way, with what you've laid down and what you might lay down. So I don't know. Sometimes I feel as if maybe that's the way I have to do it. I have to write every novel 4 times. You know, not 4 different novels, but in the process of it, just kind of work it and work it and work it. And I'm a slow writer too. I'm pretty methodical, and so I'm not the sort of writer who can jam out 2,000 words and then go back and fix them and be happy with it. So it's coal mining.
Yeah. So it sounds to me that you're essentially working from working almost off of a continuous first draft. That once you have it relatively precise, there's not really a lot of line editing that goes on or anything along those lines.
Yeah,
later.
There's not a small editing that goes on. There's a lot of chopping off, and then reattaching.
Yeah.
prosthetic limbs here and there.
Yeah. Team of surgeons coming.
Yeah, it's transplant surgery for me. And yes, it is like a first draft that's first and only draft that's gone through many, many iterations.
Is this what caused the 2-year delay for this book? Because I was like saying to myself, well, wait a minute, this was scheduled for 2008.
Yeah, well, yeah, partly.
What else caused this delay?
Life. I teach as well, and I have 2 young girls, and I enjoy my family life, and so there are lots of things going on, and also just I think I have a pretty good work ethic. It's just my poor record of actually producing decent prose.
So
at a good clip. At a,
So well, then this makes me ask, what is the Chiang Rae-Lee writing routine here? I mean, in terms of how much you must devote every week. I mean, how much do you devote every week? And how much of that involves in material that represents these chapters or these sections or these little books that you're happy with?
Yeah, well, I would say when I'm just doing my solid work and not teaching, say, that day, I'm working from early in the morning to lunch, break for lunch, and working to the late afternoon. So it really is an all-day affair.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, sometimes I'll get 250 words out of that.
Wow.
Eight hours. Wow. Sometimes I'll get 1,000.
Yeah.
But more often than not, it'll be a lot fewer.
So you shoot for hours rather than words, basically.
Yeah, because I can't. I don't know what's going to happen. And I don't know how I'm going to feel about those words. And I don't want to be wedded to those words just because they have a count.
If you have a 1,000-word day, do you distrust those 1,000 words?
I do, actually. although I must say, the chapter that starts out the novel, it's not the first chapter I wrote, but it is the first chapter of The Surrendered. I wrote that in a matter of a day and a half, 2 days.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just flowed. And I distrusted it for a long time.
Well, what chapter took the longest to write in this book?
Probably the last chapter.
Uh-huh.
Because it's not about... I think last chapters are hard for me because, for me, there's... You're not worried about plot.
Yeah.
You're not... Not really. You shouldn't be, I don't think.
Well, you know the threads are going to be wrapped up here. Yeah, yeah.
You should have done all your work with character at that point. Really, it's about hitting certain notes.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, those are literally notes. I really feel I can hear the way I want the chapter to end. And it's hard to sometimes get that, because, of course, it's not just one note. It's this certain kind of building. And I've always had I've always spent a lot of time on that final chapter.
When Sylvie enters the equation, we actually go backwards through time, and I'm wondering if that was a surprise for you as much as it was for the reader, me at least, here.
It was, because I didn't really know that much about Sylvie. I knew, at that point, I knew something about her parents, and that the fact that they were also zealous missionaries. But then I started asking, well, where were they as zealous missionaries? And I said, oh, maybe they were in Asia. Maybe they were in China. at this time, and just looking at their chronologies, I thought, okay, this would be a good time. And then I was looking around, and I thought, oh my goodness, why? It'd be great if they were in Manchuria during the Japanese incursions there, and because so many horrible things happened during that time, a lot of atrocities, as we know, in the late 30s, in China, northern China, and then central China. So that was a surprise to me. And then when I wrote down, 1934 in my notebook, saying this is the year I'm going to write about, I had no idea what was going to happen in that chapter. Yeah. But I knew, basically where it was set, and that they would encounter trouble.
So for you, it sounds like you really needed to zero in on these characters by writing, as opposed to thinking about it, or at least going through the thinking process of writing.
The writing is always the way that I think.
Yeah.
And maybe other writers do it differently, but obviously, it's not as if I'm not thinking at all beforehand, but I do have a sense of what...
I was trying to declare you an autistic or something. Right. Yeah.
But the most important kind of thinking, I think the most interesting and compelling kind of thinking, does happen in stream.
Yeah.
In situ, as it were, right? In the heat of that sentence.
Yeah.
And that's where you figure out, I think, I've always felt, that's where the most exciting and unlikely parts about character come out, because of what you've written, not because ever what you've thought.
This makes me also ask you about the many references throughout the book, not just character names like Jung and Hector, and even one might argue the George Washington Bridge, but also, of course, the Battle of Solferino. And that also made me wonder whether Hector almost served as this this Jean Henri Dunant type or something, where he was witnessing all this terrible stuff around him and serving almost as a custodian, so to speak. I'm curious about whether such classical references really aid you to zero in on the part of writing you don't seem to like, which is plotting the whole great mammoth beast out.
Yeah, well, I think with Hector, definitely, he actually didn't start out as Hector from the Iliad. Huh. He started out as someone from Southwest Texas, and that's why his name was Hector.
It's very interesting. Wow.
But of course, you can't ever hear the word and name Hector and not think of those things if you've read, those books and those works. And obviously, I'm someone who lives with literature and thinks about it. And so it was just sort of serendipitous that all the kind of classical references and came about. And, the more I looked into it, I thought, oh, yeah, he grew up in a town called Ilion, New York. And I looked into Ilion, New York, and lo and behold, it was the home of Remington Arms.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, they had the highest... percentage of war bond buying of any town in the country. Yeah. So I thought, wow, this is a great, great coincidence, and I'm gonna run with it. And again, that's the kind of thing that suggests plot, right? It suggests scenes for Hector's youth and scenes for, and also, of course, a suggestion of a certain kind of character. And I wanted to. The more I thought about him, the more I thought he's the anti-Hector.
Yeah,
he's not the noble son, he's not the pride of the town. He's someone pride of the city. He's someone who's completely fallen and has pushed himself to fall.
But he also has this remarkable fortitude when it comes to drink, when it comes to being rumbled when he's like in his 40s. I mean, this to me makes me wonder. Well, was Hector at this point when these little moments came about? Was he more of the Hector from Texas, or was he more of the Hector that we all know and love in classical times?
Well, in fact, he was actually wanted him to be more like Achilles. but I don't think readers have actually really, said this to themselves in the reading of it, and I don't make it too much of it, but I did want him, I did see him as an immortal in this book. That's someone who's cursed with this titan body and this titan constitution, and that it would he would consider his disease, that he had to endure and witness and persist. And I think that's one of the first words that I associate with him is persistence, and which is something that we think of as a good thing, but in this book, a complicated thing.
One quick last question, because I know you've got a jam. I wanted to ask you about whether you believe this fourth book represents this effort to, I suppose, break away from your two chief influences, which you've said over and over again, are Cheever and Updike. I mean, Updike, of course, wrote his own little colonialist book, right. But I'm curious as to how much this need to sort of, I guess, get away from suburban life and what comes of that.
Well, I don't think I ever said Cheever and Updike were my principal. I think I probably said that I admired their work and it spoke to me.
Yeah.
Partly because I'm a creature of the suburbs, yeah, and, you know, a product of the suburbs, but unfortunately. No, I don't think it's... I mean, I didn't mean to get away from anything with this book. It was more diving into a subject that I'd wanted to and was struggling with and hoping to handle for many years. You know, I've been trying to write this book since before A Gesture Life,
yeah,
which is about 12 years now.
Why did it take so long to come to
it? I had a lot of fitful starts, and in the meantime, I found other stories. You know, I found A Gesture Life in a loft, and I think my sense of this story was that its scale was not something I could take lightly, yeah, and that it wasn't the kind of book where I didn't feel that it was going to be an ordinary experience writing this book.
You had to grow up in order to...
mature, yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways, as a writer and as a person, you know, I could not have written this book 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. And not because so many horrific, traumatic things have happened to me, but, you know, that's what life is. We observe and we gather and we, you know, we somehow things begin to seep in about how you see the world and how you'd like to see the world.
But isn't there a danger in laboring too much over the words? Do you worry about them not being fresh if you're constantly dwelling upon how a sentence looks? I mean, you know, how do you correct these perfectionist impulses? How do you contend with them, rather?
Well, I guess I don't worry because I don't know any other way to do it. Mm-hmm. And I do want the language to be fresh or whatever. Well, no, I don't know about fresh. I don't care if it's fresh. I just want it to be beautiful.
Okay.
And true, you know. So if I can have a little bit of poetry and a little bit of truth, and it takes me, you know, a gazillion years to write a damn paragraph, that's okay. That's okay.
Well, Chiang Rae Lee, thanks so much for taking the time. It was a pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Great, thanks. I'd be a fool to try to escape you, and maybe I'm